there's a huge creative element to doing these extra things, like learning how to market, like marketing and marketing copy. That's creative. Learning how to talk about your art and how to get people to pay attention to your art. That's a creativity. Learning how to pitch a publicist or pitch, not a publicist, but like pitch a newspaper and writing that email. That's creative. Editing your videos. That's creative. And it could and it should and it will inform the rest of your art for sure. And it will give you ideas, you know, how to tackle that script or that new speech or whatever it is that you're creating.
This is the Cracking Creativity Podcast, episode number 40 with Josh Ribidoff. Welcome to the Cracking Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Chung, and I'm here to show you how creatives turn their ideas into action, create interesting projects, and build an engaged audience through shared passions. Now let's get creative. In this episode of the Cracking Creativity Podcast, I talked to Josh Ribidoff, the founder and director of The Impossible Project. He is also the author of two books and the star of his own one-man show. Josh came courtesy of a mutual friend and former guest, Mark Guay. In it, Josh talks about overcoming his near suicide, the importance of marketing for artists, and lessons we can learn from failure. Now on to the episode. Welcome to another episode of Cracking Creativity. Today I'm on Josh Ribidoff, and he is an author, international speaker, an actor, and the founder and executive director of the Impossible Project or Impossible Project. You can look at it either way. Josh, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, so I am the executive director and founder of the Impossible Project, which is a nonprofit media company designed to engage, entertain, and educate on suicide prevention, mental health, and diversity. And it is a relatively new foundation, but we're moving some mountains, which is really interesting. And we just had a book come out, 50 stories, inspirational, motivational stories of overcoming obstacles, cancer, mental health, suicide, homicide, a transgender man finding love, some really hard-hitting stories, and we just debuted number one in the suicide category on Amazon, and the book is a required curriculum at the School of Social Work at UT Arlington, and so I also happen to be a public speaker, and that's a lot of what I do with the Impossible Project. That's kind of what I'm doing and where I'm moving with it in addition to the book. And I've been doing that work for almost 5 years, telling my story through theater, a one-man show, because I'm an actor. That's how I started out. I started out in New York City as a theater actor. I still do voiceover work. I'm in L.A. now. And so I lost my dad to suicide in 2009. He lost his dad to suicide in the late 1960s, and I nearly made an attempt on my life in 2011. And I got help, and thankfully I got help, and I was able to use the one-man show that I had created after my dad's passing, which happened to be about, it's a comedy, largely a comedy where I play, you know, 15 to 20 characters, and I sing a little bit in it. It also deals with my dad's suicide at the very end, and so I was able to use that show, plus get educated and then become an educator, to talk to colleges and high schools and juvenile detention centers and community centers and conferences, to educate on suicide prevention and mental health and how and where to get help and what help looks like. And so since 2011, I've been to 105 locations in 4 countries, and have spoken to over 20,000 people. And so, and been saving lives. So that is what I'm really excited about. That's what I do. I also am a diversity trainer, and I work on college campuses doing that as well. And there's a few other things, but I'm going to cut it short because nobody wants to hear anyone spit out their resume. Yeah, that's largely what I do. I would say I'm an educator, an author, and I run this foundation, the Impossible Project.
Hmm. Did you start off being an artistic or creative person when you were growing up, or is that something you developed later on?
I've always been a creative person, an artistic person. My family, my parents, had always sung in church when I was a kid. And I started doing that as well. I've been in choirs, you know, I was in choirs from the age of 6 to 19. And so at a very young age, I was doing school plays. And I could never figure out why the other kids, and especially the boys, didn't like being in the plays. I was like, well, this is awesome. What are you talking about? This is fantastic. I had such a great time doing it. I couldn't figure out why the guys didn't like it. And, I, you know, it's kind of not a, usually a guy thing, I guess. But yeah, always been singing and acting and writing a little music and, not the best drawer, but you know, I make it happen once in a while. But it's, I think the creativity piece has sort of been in my blood for a long time.
Did you go to school for, something creative?
I did. I went to Atlantic Acting School, which was founded by, William Macy and David Mamet. David Mamet's a pretty prominent playwright, and William Macy, I can't remember the show. He's on a show on Showtime right now. He's been in tons of movies. He looks kind of like a real-life Ned Flanders. You'd know him if you saw him. And so I went to school there for acting, and I trained with a pretty prominent voice teacher, for you know, a music voice teacher in New York City. And I did a lot of improv as well in New York City. I trained at the People's Improv Theater. And I've also done some voice and body work that just kind of help you with your acting on a very, you know, just a bodily level. So yeah, I've got a lot of training under my belt, and it's really helped out in a lot of ways inside and outside of the arts.
Hmm. Is there a specific moment either in your childhood or while you were attending school that made you realize this is what I want to do?
Well, I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's probably a couple moments. One of them I remember, I was watching a family reunion video and there was a couple cameras, you know, people were shooting different things. And so somebody was shooting, me, and I was like a little 6-year-old kid with a bad haircut. And every time that I saw that the camera was on me, I started jumping and dancing around and really kind of getting up for the hype of being on camera. So that's kind of a memory. And then I remember another one in high school. I was a sophomore and I had the second male lead in the play and the musical, and it was so exhilarating. I had such a good time, and I think for high school I did a good job. I mean, you know, we all think we're great even when we're kids. But it was kind of then where I was like, this is kind of addictive and I really want to keep singing and acting and kind of figuring out the show business thing. So those are kind of two points I think in my life that I specifically remember, like, I got to do this. I need to do this.
Once you left college, what was the first thing that you did, after you completed it?
The first thing I did was a summer stock show, summer stock, meaning they run these pieces of theater, you know, like a show, in repertory, like back to back to back, like, so there's no break, and it's usually in some small town, sometimes they're bigger towns, but I did The Sound of Music, and I played Rolf, which is that, you know, I am 16 going on 17 character, and he's the love interest of the young girl, and he ends up becoming a Nazi, and so apparently I played a convincing Nazi. I don't know. not really my claim to fame, but yeah, so I did that, and then the next show I did, I was Willard and Footloose, which is kind of the dumb guy. If you've ever seen the movie, it's definitely a stage musical, and then there was I had some small role in Arsenic and Old Lace, which is a play, and so it was a 7-week thing, and it was back to back to back, and I got paid virtually no money, and we stayed on a college campus, and it was totally exhilarating and fun and just a blast.
Hmm. Is that something that sparked your further interest? Is that something you're like, oh yes, this is something I want to do?
Yeah, you know, it was that that really kind of pushed me on, because I had not moved out of my parents' house at that point yet, And after that, my buddy wanted to move near New York City to finish his college education, and he wanted a roommate, so I took him up on that, and I started commuting to New York City and was auditioning. I was like, I should be getting more work, and so I had the director who directed me in Sound of Music had a small project over Christmas that I got to do. So I kind of went in a little in between some time. There was some time where I wasn't working, but I was auditioning and kind of figuring out the scene. And so I got another job, and that was great. And then the following year I got some roles in it's kind of embarrassing, but a couple of small reality shows. and then I was rehearsing a musical that was workshopping. And then the year after it was when I really started booking a lot of work, and getting Broadway auditions and getting big callbacks and stuff like that. So, there was a string of about 5 years where I was really, really cooking with the theater stuff, and it was really addictive and it was really fun and it was really hard, but I enjoyed it.
At what point relative to that did, your father commit suicide and then like all your stuff happened? I know you had a lot of terrible events happen straight in a row.
Yeah. So that would have been, so I kind of stopped working a ton in 2007, and then my parents got divorced in late 2008, and then my dad took his life in 2009. So between 2007 and 2008, I'd started writing plays, and I started producing work because I wasn't really happy with the kind of work I was getting. And I was getting callbacks for Broadway stuff, and I was getting close, and then I had a manager who's kind of like an agent, and his agency folded, and that didn't bode well for me. And so I was kind of getting burnt out on the whole thing. And it was, I think if I waited that out a couple, another year or so, like even after my dad died, I would be, working on Broadway and doing a lot of the big things that I wanted to, because all my friends who I was in class with, I would say at least 10 of them are working consistently on Broadway and regional theater and stuff. And some are even on television, which is really interesting to see. But, when something traumatic like that happens, I mean, your life kind of takes a left turn. And so I ended up creating a one person show after my dad died. And that was sort of in the works already. I was kind of thinking about taking a playwriting class, and it the spots were full. So I ended up taking this one man show class, which I was kind of inspired to do anyway. And from there, I wouldn't say it blew up, but I wrote it and I was working on it and I was working on some other things. And then in 2010, a year after he passed away, I put it up in New York City and it did really well, got good reviews. And I put it up in Philadelphia and was invited to come back a year after that. And then 2011 is kind of where it all really fell apart. The beginning of 2011, where I nearly made an attempt on my life and I was just in a bad spot. And really, and from there, that's where all this impossible work really came from, was, being able to get help and wanting to help other people and all that, merging creativity and advocacy. So, it's been an interesting journey, to say the least.
Can you talk about the moment where you were thinking about it, committing suicide, and all of the events that were surrounding that moment and how you kind of transitioned out of that?
Yeah. So in the moment, and it wasn't a singular moment, but it was about 6 weeks of a really deep, dark depression where I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep. I would cry for no reason. I was in emotional pain. I was in physical pain, and the stuff surrounding it, my dad was gone at that point for almost 18 months, and my mom and I were not in a good relationship at that point. She had sued me and my brother and sister for my dad's inheritance, and that really hurt, and I felt betrayed, so I felt like I had no parents. My girlfriend of 6 years left me at that point as well, and I was, in a new apartment and isolating and not, doing anything with friends or not really taking care of myself. And all of that sort of combined, the depression and the loss of three people, really kind of made me, or contributed to, I should say, this idea that I'm not worthy of living and that I you know, the option of suicide was on the table, and these were persistent thoughts, and sometimes I could control them and sometimes I couldn't. And in that moment where I was hanging out of a window and I nearly jumped, I had something inside my head that said, go back inside and ask for help. And I couldn't figure out why I should do that. And it was kind of like the voice or providence or God or conscience or whatever was like, you know, I don't think you want to die. I just don't think you want to feel like this anymore. So go back inside and ask for help. And so I sat on my bedroom floor and I just kind of was reciting this mantra that just kind of came into my mind and came into my head. And it was like, please help me connect to positive people, positive thoughts and positive experiences. Cause I just wasn't connecting to them. I had no positive people or thoughts or experiences at that point. And so I was sort of trying to, you know, unknowingly kind of trying to manifest that. And after about an hour of repeating that to myself, I had the impetus to call my mother, because I was sort of a like natal at that point. I was kind of almost a baby. Like, and I was like, I just want my mom. And I didn't know what else to do. And even though we weren't in a good relationship at that point, I felt like that's something I should have done. And so I did. And it was a risk because I didn't, you know, we hadn't been talking. And I, even though she hadn't been good to me, I certainly was not good back to her. And I said things that I don't regret, but were a bit harsh. And so we talked and I broke down on the phone, and she knew where the conversation was going. And she asked me if I was thinking about taking my life. And I said, yes. And at first she tried to give some bad advice. It was bad advice to me. And then I told her if she didn't stop, you know, I would hang up. And so she changed her tactics. And from there, she did everything a person is supposed to do when talking to someone who is suicidal. I mean, she just listened to what I had to say. She didn't judge me. She was sympathetic. She told me that my life was important to her, which is really big. You know, I think we all want to feel important and that we matter. And having that concept and that idea for anybody, whether they're suicidal or not, is tremendously important. For me, it was an anchor, you know, to know that I had a purpose, at least even a grain of a purpose, in that moment. And it kind of fed me into the next day or two, where I could kind of had some clarity of thought to start researching like resources and like what I was going through and what I needed to do for myself. And so from there, you know, I started mapping out what was going on in my brain. I started journaling. Some of it was creative and some of it was just, you know, just sort of almost like a blog post, but written entirely for myself. I was making it a point to really force myself to get out and see the good people in my life. And then there was a little bit of spirituality that I sort of employed, which is a very personal thing. I'm not a very vocal person when it comes to spirituality, because I think everybody's got something different going on, and nobody's right. It's like whatever's right for them. and then exercise and eating right was important, and I started developing good habits in that arena. And then I got into therapy a few months later, and in between that and therapy, you know, one of the biggest things that I found was like to be whole again, I need to put myself in the service of others, because all I'd really been focusing on was theater and getting ahead and being an actor and making it. And that left little time for my own mental health, and it really left little time for other people, in a meaningful way. And so, so that really led to this idea that I can take this one man show and use it as a tool to educate other people, you know, people who aren't necessarily in the know about resources and the signs and symptoms of suicide or mental health issues, and how they can get help and what help looks like and what recovery looks like and things like that. So, so that's sort of the manifestation of kind of what happened from top to bottom, you know, like being suicidal and then coming out of it and then, you know, kind of what grew from it in the aftermath.
How did the one man show change from before that moment and after that moment?
So the one man show changed, kind of a no brainer. I've got to update the pop culture references all the time. Especially with youth audiences, they don't know who Sanford and Son is. But a lot of it, I think, changed in the acting. You know, my acting in the show changed, where I was less judgmental of my father when playing him. And then, you know, it'll change if I've got to do a 30-minute show versus a 45-minute show. And so that's just really kind of taking some of the filler out and stuff like that. But what really changed, the big thing that changed, was that I was able to put a keynote speech on at the end of it and do that education and really make it a focus to use it as an educational tool. So, yeah.
What do you do for the keynote, and how do you incorporate that into the play side? How do you, like, converge those two different ideas?
Yeah, so the way I converge the two, and there does happen to be a Q&A on the back end as well, so it becomes a 90-minute event. but the way I transition from the play is I sort of, because usually I don't do it in a theater, I'll do it in, like, an auditorium or a lecture hall. And I kind of prefer it that way because it kind of strips it down and it kind of makes it more real. There's a moment in between the two where I kind of take a break. I do a beat change. My body changes a bit. And they see that. The audience sees that. And I kind of decompress and I say, okay, this is the point in time where we switch over. Because they know what they're getting. The way that the program is introduced, they know it's going to move from one to the next. And I say, this is a point in time where, like, if this is a traditional piece of theater, there'd be a curtain that would go up and down. Lights would go, you know, on and off. And I take a bow, and I'm still going to take a bow because I want to thank you for being a good audience, but we've got to move into this next section so we can talk about what we've just seen. And so I can kind of give you, a little context for what you've just seen. And so beyond that, then I take the bow and then I start talking about, you know, the history of the piece and my brief history. And then I talk a little bit about people who've had suicide in their families, like me. And then I kind of jump into some statistics, on suicide just as a frame of reference so they understand how serious it is and how prevalent it is and not as a scare tactic. And then I talk about the signs and symptoms of suicide and what that looks like, and just so they can be aware. And then I move into how to help a friend or how to help yourself. And I model the conversation I had with my mom as what to do and what not to do. And then I move into what help is and the resources, and then resources are. And then at the end, I challenge them, you know, on not just the mental health and suicide level, but, you know, to be a friend, to be the change that they want to see, and to not be afraid to tell their story. Because my story has had such an impact, and I want other people to be able to do the same thing. And I know a lot of people want to do that, and they don't know where to get started or how to do it. So it's really, it kind of really flows. And then we jump into the Q&A, and that's a nice component because I get to hear, you know, what their concerns are and what they enjoyed and what they want to know and what's kind of burning in the community or on campus and what needs to be addressed. So it's pretty rewarding and that's kind of, you know, top to bottom, the 90-minute program. Hmm.
What are some of the questions that stood out to you while taking Q&A sessions?
There's always questions, like specific questions, like I know somebody and they don't want to get help. Like, what do I do for that? Like, what do I do if somebody doesn't want to get help? And there's no perfect answer to that question. I mean, there's certainly different ways to sort of, there's different tactics, like asking your friend to go with you. You know, if your friend doesn't want to get help, you can say you can go with them, or, you know, you can say do it for me and not for you. I mean, and none of them are perfect, as far as an answer. And I always make sure to tell those students also to get help for themselves, because, you know, if somebody's leaning on them and they're the only support for that person, like, at some point, they're going to get frayed at the edges too. So practicing self-care is really important. I think that's a big one. That's the one I hear a lot. That's one of the standouts. Nothing else is coming to mind, but I know that I do get kind of some of the same questions a lot.
So what recommendations do you make for people who are in that situation and want to get help or are trying to help people?
I think if you're trying to help somebody, the most important thing you can do for that person is to listen to them. Just listen to them. I know we want to fix it and you want to tell them, you know, it's going to be okay tomorrow, or think about the starving kids in Africa, or your friends and family would be so mad at you. And maybe that comes from a good place and, you know, you're well intentioned, but really what people want to be is they want to be heard. Especially because it's such an invisible sort of thing going on, the suicidal thinking or depression or what have you. And so by listening to them, you're just validating that what they're going through is real. So listening without then giving advice on the back end. The next thing that you can do really is to validate them and say, like, yeah, well, I don't quite understand, but I do know that what you're going through is real, and I'm here for you, and you're important to me, and I want to make sure that you're okay. If in that conversation, so this is a tricky part, but it's not about giving advice. It's more about active listening. And if you hear them say something about, you know, grandma or the puppies and they're the only ones who could, you know, apply grandma's insulin pen, or nobody will walk the puppies without them, you might want to, like, you know, reframe that back to them when they're done talking, and just kind of, you know, when you're ready to talk about help and that kind of a thing, just, you know, you are important and you matter. And, you know, if you go, the puppies aren't going to make it because nobody else is going to help them, you know, and same thing, your grandma, you know, nobody's going to help grandma with the insulin pen. And that's just a starting point. Like, that's not, you know, the end point. That's just to get their brain moving in a different direction. And then you also want to figure out what professional help exists in the area. I mean, there are suicide prevention hotlines. There's the national one, which is 800-273-8255, and that's in the U.S. And that's really, I mean, that's not the be all end all. That's a good supplement. You know, that's a good thing for, you know, if it's 3 a.m. and you don't know where to go or what to do, and you're in crisis or somebody else is in crisis, you can call them and ask what local resources are. You know, you'll at some point want to talk to a counselor, or a mentor or clergy. But the point is, like, you need to get that person who's in crisis, you need to get them talking about what they're going through, preferably to a professional. So those are a few things that you can do for somebody, who's in crisis. And if you yourself are in crisis, you know, again, there's the suicide prevention hotline, and there's also probably, like, local hotlines. There tends to be a lot in different regions. You know, you'll want to just make sure you're safe. You know, try to get in touch with somebody or somebodies who you trust. And just, you know, if you think you're going to harm yourself, try to get with somebody. You know, it's a lot harder to harm oneself when you're with a person, a group of people. And just know that you're important and that you matter. Even if you don't think so right now, I've been in a place where, you know, I was at the end of my rope, and I really had to search for that, you know, for me feeling like I was important and that I mattered. So those are a few things as well that a person in crisis can look to for help.
Have you ever felt yourself slipping back into that train of thought?
No, I've never moved back into suicidal thinking. I do, however, deal with depression on a daily basis, and usually it's very mild. And I've had two major depressive episodes in my life, and one was you know, back when I was also engaged in suicidal thinking in 2011. And the second one was in September into October of 2015. So relatively recently. The difference between the two was in 2015, I had tools to help myself manage that much better, you know, exercise, eating right, self-coaching, a therapist, you know, lots of different things that I had employed over the years. And so, I got through that without thinking about suicide, and I got through it much faster.
Was that caused by like another series of events similar to the first time, or was it just, you know, one of those out of the blue?
It wasn't similar events. I had been caregiving for someone for the better part of that year, somebody dealing with cancer, and so that was just a really, really and then a breakup too. So between the two and just not taking care of myself as well as I should have, it was just the kind of those series of events that kind of led to that.
So it's all about getting back to the place where you're surrounded by people
mm-hmm.
that are, you know, want to be supportive, even though they're not trying to tell you what to do. And like the positive attitude, I think, mm-hmm. is also very important as far as, you know, getting out of that rut.
Yeah, I mean, that can be a slippery slope. I mean, it's not all attributed to positive attitude. I mean, right. I think it's really more so even an optimism. I think it's just like, I'm going to work on this. And even if it's not, doesn't seem like it's getting better at the moment, like I'm going to keep working at it and I'm going to grind on it. And I'll do my best to try to be positive, even when it doesn't seem like the positivity is working. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just putting in the work.
Right. Just like anything
else,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely. And staying the course. And I mean, I can attribute to that. I mean, just it's not a perfect analogy, of course, but like just being an entrepreneur, like, I mean, there are days that are a big roller coaster. I'm like, stay with the process. You're doing fine. You know, it might not seem like it's going well today, but there's tomorrow, there's this evening, there's next week, and it works out because I stay the course and I put the tools in, you know, the tools that I have in place, you know, I work through them. Same thing with, you know, my marriage. I mean, you know, I've been married for 2 months and I love my wife and she loves me and we love each other dearly. And, you know, and it's a great marriage, but you know, we've got to stay the course and we just put our heads down and know that we're committed. And some days are easier than others. And it's just important that, you know, to always, you know, if you're in a fight or something, that it's not the end of the world. You know, it's process it, you know. So and put the work in. And that's, you know, entrepreneur, marriage, depression, you know, just commit to the process.
Can you talk a little bit about the Impossible Project, how you decided you wanted to form this and some of the goals and ideals of what you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so the formation of the Impossible Project really is derived from my story, the one-man show. Originally, it was called The Gospel According to Josh, and now it's called Kicking My Blue Jeans in the Butt. But it came from that because while on tour, while speaking to 20,000 people, after each presentation, each program, you know, somebody tells me their story, you know, whether it's sexual assault or homicide or suicide or fatherhood. And each of these stories, I mean, they're powerful in their own right. And they certainly change my worldview and they change the way I look at the world and they affect me in a very positive way. And so some of these people too are like, they're just yearning for a platform to be able to tell more people about what it is that they know and their knowledge and their experience and their life experience. And so, I had this impetus to tell other people's stories because I know how positive mine has been on my life and on thousands of other people. And I wanted to give other people opportunities to do so. And so with the book, you know, it's really about storytelling and really with the foundation, with each of the programs that we offer, you know, it's all derived from storytelling, you know, because most of our work falls under seminars and workshops and speaking events and training. But it falls under a story, and storytelling is one of the most powerful things. It's one of the, it's probably the oldest art form that we have as a human species. you know, you kill the saber-toothed tiger and you know, you got a couple hunters, and who's going to talk about it? You know, it's the storyteller. They're going to talk about all about how it happened, and in a way to sort of relate to the rest of the group what the experience was and how amazing it was, et cetera. And so moving forward, I mean, we've got plays, we've got musicals, we've got stand-up poetry, and how powerful a story is. I mean, when we tell a story and it connects with people through metaphor or through simile or through just the experience itself, it fires a synapsis. It fires synapses in a person's brain, and it lights up a person's brain differently. Where, especially when using a metaphor, if you talk about kicking a ball and you talk about it in a metaphorical way and you talk about it in a way that engages somebody, the lights in their brain, the synapses in their brain will light up in a way that they're actually doing the action being talked about. So that to me means that in the instance of like suicide and prevention, talking about help leads to getting help. It's going to move feet towards getting help and to making choices to stay alive. Same thing with mental health, same thing with, you know, being, you know, having a diverse college campus and things of that nature. So really I just wanted to share my story, and I want to share other people's story, other people's stories, so we can affect positive change, in thousands, in millions, in billions of people's lives. Because I think storytelling is going to be the thing that saves us. And so that's where the impetus came from this book. As well, you know, telling stories of a transgender man finding love for the first time, or a woman overcoming her son's homicide, or somebody having the courage to tell their story about having multiple sclerosis. These stories, you know, whether it's in the book or in these programs that we're offering, they are affecting people in a positive way. And so that's really where it all came from. I wanted to tell stories that were going to move people's feet to live positive, healthy, productive lives.
What makes a good story?
Well, a good story, it's kind of a subjective thing, but I would say what makes a well-told story is in the way it's told. I think using descriptive language is always a good thing. And descriptive meaning like getting a metaphor or two in there, using the word like and as, that kind of a thing. Knowing your audience, knowing that if you're speaking to a biker gang, you could probably say the F word, but if you're speaking to a boardroom, you probably can't say the F word. I mean, that's a kind of that's an easy pitch to hit. Quotes are always a good thing. If you're trying to, it depends on the format and the medium that you're telling your story. I mean, if, telling a well-told story through spoken word is different than telling a well-told story as a public speaker, as a playwright, as a screenwriter. But I think when telling a piece of nonfiction, it's the quotes, it's telling, you know, a positive quote, it's knowing your audience, it's the descriptive language, and it's in the delivery as well. It's in the way that your cadence, it's in your hand gestures and your body movements and your body language. I think those are some important notes and some important pieces to a well-told story.
Yeah. I think two of the important things that you mentioned there are knowing who the audience is. So it definitely makes a difference how to tell the story once you know who is going to receive the story.
Yes.
Because you can't just tell, you know, a group of teenagers the same story that you're going to tell a group of elderly people. It's just not the same at all. Because you said during your run you had to update, you know, the pop culture references, and that's just an example within the same demographics. So if you're going from one spectrum to the other, it's definitely going to change a lot.
That's right. That's right. It's exactly right. You know, because if it could, you could be telling, you could have a great speech for a boardroom. It could hit like gangbusters. But to try to capture that same magic and talk to a bunch of 8-year-olds with the same message, obviously that's an extreme example, it's not going to hit. It's not going to have any impact. You might as well not even show up. So the audience thing is tremendously important. Yeah.
And also, yeah, the message. So what message are you trying to get across? If you're trying to push a message to one group, it's not going to be the same message to another group. It all depends, like, again, on the audience and mm-hmm. how you communicate.
That's right. That's right. It is. It's on how you communicate. And really having a specific theme and really knowing the message that you want to get across and really defining that near the beginning, probably within the first 5 minutes, you really want to make sure that people know why the hell you're there and why, you know, why you're the one to deliver that message and why they need to hear that message.
So what was the main message that you were trying to get across through your one-man play?
With the one-man play, I want people to know that suicide is preventable. Well, when I'm speaking to college audiences, because I will do this in different arenas, at conferences, at community centers and juvenile detention centers, but when I'm talking to college students, I want them to know that suicide is preventable. I want them to know that there's hope and there's healing available. There's resources out there. That they can utilize, and that recovery is possible, and that they can be anything and do anything that they want. And I, a very simple guy from New Jersey, originally from New Jersey, am living proof.
How did you find people for the book?
Yeah, that was quite an interesting process, finding people for this book. Some of them were my friends. Some of them were people I met on my journey while touring with the one-man show. Some of them were cold emails and cold calls, people who I really liked their work and what they were doing. Some of them were a bit warmer in the fact that I knew they were colleagues and we may have met once or twice, but we didn't really have a relationship. And I reached out to them you know, initially, the book has 50 stories, but I have probably aggregated and collected about 95. I have about 95 stories. So I really had to kind of mix and match and figure out which ones worked best together and a specific through line for this first book. So it was an interesting process. And we finished editing around September of this year. And so frankly, I mean, from the beginning of the project until now, it was a 2-year process in releasing the book.
How did you narrow down to 50 stories from that 95?
Well, I didn't have all the 95 stories in the beginning. I mean, I've even been collecting stories like right now. I mean, there's people who've been sending me stories. But I narrowed down based on category. You know, the categories that I decided were going to be right for the book, I narrowed down based on somewhat. I mean, I edited all the stories, whether they were in the book or not. I curated it and edited it, and based on how powerfully told the story was, because there's only so much doctoring up I can do. But it was how well told the story was. Not saying that the story that they sent in wasn't valid or wasn't good or didn't have its own positive effect, but I needed to put the most powerful ones in that I could. And I mean, logistically speaking, I mean, there were a few people who weren't pleasant to deal with, and so that's an easy choice in not putting them in. But for the most part, I mean, everyone's been just wonderful and pleasant, and especially the ones who are in this book now. I mean, they're all wonderful. So there was a few different few different methods to the madness in getting these 50 stories together.
You mentioned you had a few people that you didn't know at all, and some colleagues, all these different types of people that you brought in. How did you pitch it to each of those different groups, and how did you make it compelling for them to want to share their story on your project?
Yeah, I basically, I made sure to compliment them, because everybody likes a compliment, and everybody wants to know that what they're doing is good and good work. And the compliments I gave were genuine and true. But I wanted to make sure that they knew that I appreciated what they did. And then I also gave some stats on the book and what we expected to do with it. I made certain promises about the kind of exposure, and I paid everybody as well. I mean, it wasn't a ton of money, but when starting up like that, anywhere, I think it's important that people be compensated for their time and for their efforts. You know, because when I first got to New York City and I was acting and meeting people, you know, there were certain directors or producers that said, well, we can't pay you, but, you know, for this film, but we can pay you in exposure. I'm like, I can't really pay my bills in exposure, so I'm going to have to say no to that one. So I didn't want to be that guy in the realm of publishing and in the realm of this book and this project. So I wanted to make sure that everybody was compensated as well. So I made some promises, and I pitched the idea of what the book was going to be. I told them about myself, and I made sure that they knew that I was legit and valid, and the work that I was doing was impactful. And I made sure that they knew that they were important, and that their work was important and that it mattered, and that it would be an honor to include them in this book.
I think one of the important points that you made was being paid for what you're worth, because a lot of people just take, you know, any price that comes to them, even if it is exposure, and that's a good way not to ever get out of that. So you're thinking in this small-minded way about your worth and what your art is worth. Mm-hmm. So it's all about getting into the mindset of, I've done this work for however many years and I should be paid for it. There's a story about Picasso sitting at a bench and a woman comes up to him asking for like a drawing or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he makes it in like a couple of seconds, and he asks for some large sum of money, and she's like, that only took you a couple of seconds. And he's like, no, it took me a lifetime.
That's right. That's right. It's, you know, artists need to be compensated, you know, for what they're worth. Obviously, there's times you give things away and it's a strategic move, or it's a move of goodwill or whatever. But on the day to day or on the week to week, I mean, we do need to be paid for what we're worth. And we need to demand that. And sometimes you turn away people, you turn away clients, or you turn away business, you know, for a long-term gain. I mean, you could chase down 100 clients for $5 a pop, or you could chase down one for $500. Which would you rather do? You know, that's not a perfect analogy, but artists are providing services, and they're providing, in the right context and with the right work, they're providing a solution to a problem, just like mm-hmm. banking, just like architecture, just like an accountant, in a different way. And to me, good art is less of a luxury, as some people will point out that it's, you know, art is luxury. I disagree. I think good art is a necessity when it's good, and when the proper marketing or the proper wording surrounding whatever that piece is, that's very helpful. But good art is a necessity, and so the practitioners need to really develop their business head. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I'm a creative artist. I've been in show business or the fringes of show business for almost 13 years. And what I learned as I started to move into the business arena and I started meeting all kinds of people, you know, it's not just artists that don't have a business set. I mean, there's like dentists who open up practices and they have no idea what they're doing, and they, you know, they fold, and restaurateurs because the same thing, because they didn't bother to learn the business side of what they wanted to do. It was all about the art. And frankly, you've got to pay attention to the business side as well. It's, you know, if you're not getting paid for your work, and if you're not paying attention to marketing and the business side, you're not going to be able to do your art. Plain and simple.
What do you think is causing the resistance from people to learn the business side? Because, you know, oh, I just want to create art, whatever.
Yeah. I think the resistance very well could be that they know they're not good at it. And when you know you're not good at something and you feel like you should be, you resist it. And you come up with excuses, you know, good or bad, as to why you shouldn't do it and why you put it off, and And then you start telling yourself that either you're never going to be good at it, or, you know, it's for the, you know, a pure artist shouldn't be. I mean, you start, you know, creating these scripts that don't make any sense. Like a good artist shouldn't have to be a good business person. That's total nonsense. So I think it's knowing that they're not good at it. And then maybe then one dives into it and they, you know, they know they've got to do lots and lots of different things, and which is true. You got to be good at marketing, and you'll want to get publicity, and you'll want to, you know, get good at inbound marketing, and you'll want to write a blog. And then you see this big list in front of you, and it's way more difficult to devour that list when that list is so long, rather than taking one thing at a time and becoming good at one thing at a time as you're building up your artistic business or your, you know, whatever you're doing in the arts. You know, just getting good at one thing at a time and learning about it and trusting the process and committing to it. So I think there's a few things there that prevent people from learning the business side, but it's totally achievable. I mean, I don't have a business degree, and I didn't study business, but I learned it sort of in an autodidactic way, where I just, you know, I'm taking copywriting courses and I'm taking entrepreneurial classes and reading blogs about inbound marketing and blogging and video editing and things like that, so I can stay afloat and make a living and practice my art. Because you can't really, I mean, you're not gonna do your art 40 hours a week anyway. You know, you're probably gonna do it maybe 10, 15, 20 at the most. So what are you gonna do with that other 20 hours of work? Learn how to do your business. It's important.
I think the interesting part about that also is, it doesn't deal directly with your art, but the types of things that you learn and go through by doing all those things, I think it improves your art because you get ideas that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
I agree with that. You know, and there's a huge creative element to doing these extra things, like learning how to market, like marketing and marketing copy. That's creative. Learning how to talk about your art and how to get people to pay attention to your art, that's a creativity. Learning how to pitch a publicist or pitch, not a publicist, but like pitch a newspaper and writing that email, that's creative. Editing your videos, that's creative. And it could and it should and it will inform the rest of your art for sure. And it will give you ideas, you know, how to tackle that script or that new speech or whatever it is that you're creating.
Also, the idea that, you know, art isn't done for money or whatever. When, you know, in the Renaissance, these artists were all living in people's houses creating work. They weren't creating it from themselves. They're doing it because they were commissioned to do it, and it allowed them to create while also, you know, being able to live off of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they were, exactly. I even back then in what some would call the Golden Age, I mean, they were a lot of the artists were sponsored by, you know, famous, or not famous, but rich families and stuff. I mean, they had patrons. I mean, it's a bit different of a model now, but, you know, starving is not cute, and people who are hungry don't make better art. And, you know, if you don't make money in this world, you're not going to be able to survive. And you're not going to be able to do what you want to love, you know, what you love. So you might as well figure out how to make money out of your art and figure out a creative way to do it, on some level, or else you're just not going to be able to do it. I mean, plain and simple.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing that, or a platform that has popped up within the last few years, called Patreon. Hmm. And it takes that idea of, you know, patrons from long ago, like the Medicis. Mm-hmm. And brings it to modern day. It's just spread out amongst many different patrons as opposed to, you know, one super rich patron.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. I'll have to look into that. That's certainly an interesting concept. It would be nice to see more of that happen. I mean, just as, you know, part of the marketplace. You know, there's lots of, I mean, for better or for worse, we live in a capitalist society. And so it's interesting to see the different ideas that come about, to make people's art grow in whatever sector that you're in. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So in it, you can do like, get paid per project. So every time you release a project, the people who are funding you contribute to it,
mm-hmm.
or you can do it per month. So every month you're getting paid to do it. So you're not worrying specifically about what to do to market it, mm-hmm. because you've built up a fan base who are helping to fund you and create, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
What did you learn between creating the first book and the latest book, and how you took the lessons from that and applied it?
I think the biggest thing I learned between the first and the second book is mostly has to do with marketing and promotion, and making money beyond the book sale and using the book as a multifaceted tool. The first book, I would say it took me about 2 years to really, after the book was out, to really kind of figure out, maybe a year and a half after the book was out, to really figure out how to use it as a tool. With this book, I set up a pre-order. So the book was in pre-order for 4 months, and it gave me time to to enact the marketing plan that I had created, but also to figure out which part of the marketing plan was working and which wasn't. And then, you know, getting buzz and using that to get buzz and using that to get publicity and podcasts and to get people excited and to get people to buy the book in advance and to create partnerships with organizations who were interested in helping promote the book, or, you know, to help them promote themselves. So there was a lot of things, but most of it had to do in the marketing arena.
Hmm. What do you think the biggest lesson, or the lesson that had the most impact, was?
I think that this one doesn't necessarily have to do with marketing, but I think it has to do with when you put other people as a priority before yourself. If you give people what they want before you make a request, you're going to get so much in return. So you really want to give with your art, and you want to make it about the outcome rather than the income. So in that sense, like, I made this book about telling other people's stories, and I made it about offering a portion of the proceeds to different charities who are willing to sort of give some shout outs to the book for a specific period of time. And the authors too. I mean, this is a great opportunity for exposure and for awareness and to make a little cash and to sort of maybe launch your speaking career. And so I didn't really make a lot of requests from folks. I really offered a lot. And when I did make a request, it made the request much more valid and much more easy for them to enact. And also just, people were willing to do things without me asking as well. So I think it's really about the gift and giving rather than the receiving end of it.
Hmm. I think that's important in both business and your art. So your art is a way to express yourself, but how can that also help other people, as opposed to, you know, if people say that they're creating it for themselves.
Yeah, I there's no wrong way to create art. I mean, I guess that the you know, for people who create art for themselves, or if they're a dilettante and they're dabbling, that's okay. I mean, on a certain level, you've got to create art that you like. You know, you got to create something that you enjoy. But through the process, you really have to have another person, a group, an audience in mind, because if you're selling to everyone, or if you're selling to no one, it's not going to hit with anybody. You're not going to have an audience. You're not going to have a group of people who want to have what it is that you're offering. So you always have to keep other people in mind when creating art. you know, there's always got to, the outcome has got to be, this has got to benefit somebody or somebody's in a positive way.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you want to create art for yourself, that's cool. And that's like a hobby. But if you actually want to make a living or, you know, make a business out of creating art, you can't just do it for yourself and not take into consideration other people.
Right. I mean, yeah, you otherwise it's, and it's okay. Like a hobby or community theater or something. If you don't want to do it professionally, that's totally cool. That's not for everybody. But if you're calling yourself a professional and you're, you know, being selfish with your art and not having a real audience in mind, and you might as well just put on some theater in your backyard or knit on your own or something. I mean, I don't know, but it's a very selfish attitude to take, you know, if you're not going to really keep other people in mind when creating art, if you're going to call yourself a professional.
Mm-hmm. What are your plans for the future of your project and what other types of things you want to do?
Yeah, so with the Impossible Project, we're going to keep promoting it through the year and grow the book and grow it into a series. So the idea is to have sort of a part two, a volume two of this first book, this first concept. We want to have that out next January and then perhaps have themed books out after that, like a veterans theme, and maybe, you know, a specific cause theme, or maybe even make it for specific foundations, that sort of a thing. With the with the foundation and the programming, you know, we're looking to continue on in diversity and mental health and suicide prevention. We're looking to pull in more grants and get more funding so we can offer these programs to communities who can't afford them. So either free of charge or at a reduced price, you know, reduced fee. But we're looking to do that. So we're looking to pull in more funding so we can offer that programming, to those folks who can't necessarily afford it. Looking at getting into juvenile detention centers and boys' homes and things like that. So that would also require raising some more money, because that would be a place where we wouldn't want to charge them anything. Looking at developing curriculum with a prominent school of social work that integrates storytelling, and that would sort of become populated at different universities. And then also looking to put together a speakers bureau, possibly from the authors in this book and possibly a few others, and creating a college-based club of sorts, an organization that pops up at different colleges. And it's very much like a social justice piece. So one chapter could be themed in mental health. One could be in sexual violence prevention. One could be Black Lives Matter. And so the aim of each of those chapters will be to create social justice projects in their community on a yearly basis, and functioning as sort of the eyes and ears of social justice and cause-based activity on campus.
Hmm. When you're going to tackle these new projects, like, what is your process as far as being able to accomplish them?
Process on being able to accomplish a few things. You know, I like to talk these things over with my wife, because she's got a great brain. She's really smart. And she's really talented, and she knows a lot, and we're sort of a yin and yang, so my strengths complement her strengths and vice versa. I am the one kind of driving the ship at the moment, but so after I, you know, I consult and we talk things over, I put into process, you know, timelines and things that need to be done, and sometimes the timelines aren't hit, but that's okay. You recalibrate, you figure things out, you figure out what you can do, and in, you know, what time frame, and the list of goals and when things should hit and how they hit, and who the audience is and how we're going to reach them and things like that. So and then it's testing too, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. You create the idea and then you kind of nudge people who you trust, who you think might like what you're doing or might have good feedback, and you test with them and you get them interested and maybe even involved or to take ownership of what you're doing. And from there, then you sort of soft launch it and then grow it and figure out what's hitting in the marketing, what's hitting in the content, what's hitting, you know, with the concept and what's not. And you recalibrate. So it's just always a big test process. But first, it's really consulting with my wife and then creating the content, creating the marketing, and then testing it with a small group of people, and then testing it with a bigger group until you know what we're doing makes sense and it's, you know, productive and working.
I think the most interesting thing about testing is no one knows what's going to work and what's not going to work.
Right.
Nothing in this world is, you know, definite. So a lot of people who are opposed to testing something because it might fail need to realize that they're bound to fail, right?
Yeah.
You're going to fail. It doesn't matter.
It's part of the process. Failure is part of the process. I mean, what is Edison, 10,000 times before he got the right combo for the light bulb, I think is what it is. I mean, failure is part of the process. I mean, I just recently, like, I created a music video for a new project that I'm working on, programming, actually, a new program, and it's something I wanted to complement the program. And the song was good. The video was not so good. So I got to go back to the drawing board and figure that out. And it was disappointing, and it's a failure, but it doesn't mean I'm a failure. And it didn't work out, and we'll hit it the next time. Doesn't mean it's any less painful, but, you know, things like that happen all the time, and you got to be willing to fail to succeed. I mean, it's just literally part of the process, and it's a part of the process for everybody. And the fact that people don't talk about failure more often, it kind of blows my mind. I mean, I want to hear about failure. I want to hear about what people had to do to get to where they are, because it lets me know and it lets other people know that there's no perfect process, and it's kind of unfair to expect people to hit it on the first try anyway.
Yeah. It's interesting because you look at people who are successes and you just assume that they have done everything right. And, you know, those people went through who knows how many failures.
Indeed. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I would love to have some kind of a failure conference or blog or podcast or something, because it's just something we need to talk about more. Because even failure, like, and when you get it in the right hands of the right people and people, you know, get them talking, it spawns ideas. You know, it creates new thought processes, especially, you know, if I'm sharing ideas with you and I tell you about my failure, it might help you mm-hmm. figure out what not to do or what to do. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's less about – it's not good to fail. Let's get that straight first. Sure. It's more about what can you learn from something that didn't go exactly as you planned.
Right. It's to me, failure, when in the right context, it's, you know, it's a lesson learned on the way to success. Mm-hmm. That's really what the opportunity is when failing at something.
Right. I'm going to move into the questions I asked for all my guests mm-hmm. or started to. Do you have a favorite quote?
I do have a favorite quote, and I'm going to butcher it because I can never remember the entirety of it, but it's a Gandhi quote, and it's I'm paraphrasing, but it's "be the change you want to see in the world." And I love it because, you know, if you don't like something, change it. You know, we have these invisible scripts in our head that, you know, it's always been that way, or how could I make change, or what can I do? And like, no, like things have changed before. And whether it's in government or in the community or even your personal world, you know, things have not always been like that. And somebody had to affect change to make it the way it is now. Why not have that person be you? Why not you be the spark that lights? That's the cause for the explosion that needs to happen. So be the change.
I think that is important because what you're doing is not entirely brand new.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people get stuck because they think, oh, everything I have to do, it needs to be, you know, novel or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else is a spin on something that's already occurred.
Right. It is. It is. And it's just an improvement, and it's another way of looking at it. And you're right. There are very few original ideas. It's just kind of creating something that kind of speaks to people in a new way that helps them move their feet, in a way that, you know, speaking to them in a way that gets them, you know, to move in a different way that they hadn't been able to before.
Yeah, it's your own personal take on the world, because everyone goes through different experiences, and by virtue of that, your point of view is going to be completely different from everyone else's.
That's right. That's right.
Do you have a morning routine? And if you do, what is it?
Well, yeah, I do, and I'm trying to get back to it. The morning routine has been kind of funky because of, you know, I just moved to LA about 15 days ago, so I'm trying to find my footing again. But the morning routine that I like, that I've been doing for a couple years, is to wake up, to eat breakfast, to practice language. So I like to practice French and Spanish in the morning. And then I go for a run, exercise a little bit, take a shower, play the piano, and that's like from 7 to 9, and then I'll start my work day.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you have any recommendations as far as resources, books, podcasts, documentaries that you can tell the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I really like as far as a book, I like the Pumpkin Plan by Mike Michlowitz. It's kind of just all about keeping your focus into one thing at a time and how to make that one thing grow, as opposed to trying to do too many things. I like Ramit Sethi. He's good. I Will Teach You to Be Rich. It's kind of a lifestyle blog. I really enjoy that. There's a lot of good resources there. I'm a big Seth Godin fan. He's, you know, kind of writes about different things. He's definitely a marketing guy, so his books are generally about marketing. But his blog is a little bit more general interest, and I enjoy that. I like the Impossible Project book. I'm a big fan. Not going to lie. Lots of inspiration and hard-hitting stories in there. My buddy Michael Roderick has a good blog called Investing in People, and he just started a new podcast, which I like, and I'm drawing a blank at the moment, but it's really quite good. I think it has to do with like relationship building and stuff. So it's really quite interesting, and he does a good job with that. And Benjamin Tyler's Evolving Lifestyle blog is a good one as well. So those are a few things.
Cool. Who is somebody you know personally that is extremely creative, and then somebody you don't know personally?
I'm going to give a shout to my wife on this again. I hate to be so corny or just kind of like so relationship focused, but she's super creative. I mean, she's just got a great brain, and she's always thinking about different ideas and how to augment and make things better. I mean, she grew this nonprofit that she didn't found it, but she's been there nearly from day one, and she's grown the hell out of it into like a $500,000 organization in 2.5 years. And just the ideas that she comes up for me and how we riff off of each other, I just think she's super creative and super smart. Somebody who I don't know who's super creative, I really like John Leguizamo. I think that cat is super creative. I mean, I love his one-man shows and kind of how he gets it out there and what he does, and the effort he puts into his characters and his writing. I'm a big fan of that guy.
Cool. The last question is, what is your definition of creativity, and what can people do to be more creative?
Definition of creativity, I think it's just, you know, doing something that speaks to you, that is, it's just kind of problem solving, you know, whether that's, you know, how to create that knitting pattern, or how to shoot a free throw, or, you know, how to sell your marketing practice or whatever. I mean, I think it's just about problem solving And I think it's about problem solving in sort of an arena that you care about or that you like or that you've figured out that makes your heart sing. What can people do to be more creative? Set the time aside, you know, clear your schedule. We make time for everything. We make time for love. We make time for work. We make time for sports. We need to make time for creativity, you know, set some time aside once a week, twice a week, whatever it is that you feel that you need. But we all need creativity in our lives. I mean, it's part of the holistic human experience. And so, I think how to be more creative is just, you know, set the time aside and also, you know, set the time aside to listen to listen and watch and read the things that you think, you know, inspire your creativity or things that you enjoy, creative pursuits. So read other people's work, listen to other people's stories, and also set the time aside to give yourself that opportunity to be a practitioner of creativity.
Awesome. I'd like to thank you for coming on, Josh. It's been really cool, and I think you have a lot of helpful information for people. Is there a challenge that you would like to set for people that, you know, can get them going?
Yeah, I think, you know, tell your story. Be vulnerable. You know, speak out about what it is that you want and speak out about who you are and let people know who you are, you know, whether that's in a relationship, whether that's on stage, whether that's with your boss, you know, tell your story and be vulnerable, because my story, my vulnerability, you know, after trial and error and not really knowing where it's going to take me, I mean, it led me to a career and a fulfilling lifestyle and true love and financial stability and just a healthy self-esteem. So I think, you know, tell your story and learn how to do that in a small group, and then, you know, grow that group, you know, whatever size that you want, but don't be afraid to tap into your true self and to tell people about who you are and what is it you want, what it is that you want to share with the world.
Very cool. Where can people find you online to keep up to date with all that's going on?
Yeah, so you can, my personal website is joshuarivetall.com. And then we're also at the iampossibleproject.org. So that's iampossibleproject.org. We're on Facebook as well. You can grab me at, Josh Rivetall. You can grab us at, facebook.com/iampossibleproject. There's an email list on my website. It's a weekly blog. So you can kind of check that out too. Yeah, those are probably the best ways to do it. Twitter, you know, Joshua Rivetall. Yeah, those are probably the places I would go if I were looking for me.
Cool. Yeah, thanks again for coming on. It's been a pleasure talking.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
All right, bye.
Take care.
And that's it for the 40th episode of Cracking Creativity. For show notes, go to crackingcreativity.org/40. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes at crackingcreativity.org/subscribe. Also, feel free to write a review or leave me a comment about the show. Hope this stoked your creative fires, and I'll see you next time on Cracking Creativity.